Welcome to Metacast. I am Josh Anderson.
And I'm Bob Galen.
Welcome to Agile Testing Part 2, the holiday edition. We should have Bing Crosby.
Or Part 2. Wasn't there a Part 2?
Yeah.
Yeah,
some I only know Spanish.
Or something. Was my one. That was my one word of French.
All right, so back to business since we're off track already. Yes. Thanks to me. I apologize.
It is our last Metacast of the year.
Yes.
It is the holiday season.
Yes.
And we would like to wish everyone listening, I think we've approached 5 million in active listeners. So all 5 million of you, my tongue might be in my cheek there. I wish you a Merry Christmas or a Happy Holiday, Happy New Year, whatever holidays you...
Happy everything.
Happy everything, whatever holiday celebration you... you pay attention to, and we are in testing part 2.
Duh.
So agile testing.
Yes.
So in the last Metacast, we sort of were running into, there were two parts, Josh, if I recall, that we were talking about virtualization and continuous integration and promotion models. So
yes.
Things like staging environments would be an example to me of a promotion model. And we were sort of rushing at the very end. So one area that we want to talk about is sort of how they play into agile testing. And maybe you could take the lead with some of that stuff, and I'll play off of you. And then the part two. So part two of part two is
two
part
A, two of two B.
Part two of part two. And I'm stuttering here. Is the mindset of the agile tester. We were going to explore sort of not so much tooling, but really, you know, how they operate in agile teams, and not just say, oh, they pair and then move on, right? They're just active pairs. But talk about some of the precise techniques and thinking patterns that you expect good agile, or at least I've seen good agile testers have. And
okay, sounds good.
So CI,
love it.
That's it.
We're done with that topic. So really, the thing that I've seen since I came on board in my last job, my previous job, we tried to automate as much as we could, but at my current job, we try to automate everything, which has really opened up my eyes to the possibilities and the options that are there. And virtualization has really helped us achieve that without as much pain. It's a difficult thing, without a doubt, to get things set up right and all the scripting that has to happen, and you're going to inevitably run into timing issues and things like that, and sizing issues, and trying to maintain and make sure things are set up and torn down and all that stuff, making sure it's in the right order. And the biggest thing that we don't do well enough is make those continually better. Those don't fall within our process. That's something that I'm trying to weave into our sprint goals is, let's have some stories around our CI world and what can we do to make it better. Because talking to some folks at my current job, it's been pretty stagnant. It's really good, but it's been stagnant for a couple of years now. And I think with some reasonable investment, we could take a good CI plan to a great CI plan.
Do you have anyone who... I'm trying to recall if you have people maintaining it, like that's their job. You don't, do you? Now that I recall.
No, we had one person, but it wasn't a full-time job, so it would fall off the radar, and there always were fires that came up that were more important. It didn't get the airtime that it needed, and that has shown. Now, it supports us very well in our daily check-ins and builds and everything that goes along with that, but we really could do better by trying to make it better. And there are a lot of tools that are out there that can help us.
I mean, our investment is we have a CI group, if you will, and at the last company I was at, so not my current company, we had two or three people. So the size of our group, our development team there, I'll just give you two samples.
Right.
From a maintenance point of view, the sample there was maybe 100 people in the team, testers, developers, so roughly 100. It was distributed, and we had two or three, actually two people and sort of a team lead who was doing other things and not actively coding. So 2.5 coders,
right,
if you will, were maintaining our, and it was cruise control, our cruise control environment.
Right.
And a big part of that was wiring tests in. So they were active not just in cruise control administration, but in build administration, in ancillary tools, like when we were building third-party stuff in. So they would be active in incorporating that into their environments, spinning up virtual environments, like scripting around that.
So
care and feeding that. And that was full-time. I was there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were never idle. So they had a backlog. They sprinted. They had a backlog. It wasn't gold plating. They had, now that's not a big team for 100 people. So what is that? That's, you know, that's 2 people out of 100 people who are maintaining the environments, if you will. But they were gold. And we sort of have the same model now. Less people. We don't have quite that many developers, but we have a couple of people who would care and feed. Now, our environments, that previous company, I thought we were very mature. We actually spoke at conferences. So we presented that. It was a pretty mature installation, and we presented that at conferences. Whereas where I'm at now, we're a little bit less. We're getting to that level of maturity, but it's a lot of hard work for us to get there.
Yeah, we're a catch-as-catch-can group, and that's not taking us to the next level. We're pretty stagnant, and it's a little frustrating. It's going to take some selling on my end
to invest in that.
Yeah,
it's worth the whenever I teach testing classes, I talk about CI being sort of like the foundation of agile testing, or one of those foundation points in agile teams. And I try to influence people to really invest, not a lot, but don't invest. And I'm not judging you, but don't invest zero, right? Don't build it and then let it go, right? That it needs a continual. So it's not just continuous integration. It's continuous care and feeding as well. One of the things we were doing at that previous company is we started moving. One of the challenges was databases. So having test data. So we had automated builds and we had automated tests. And there were certain things that we could mock, but there were certain things that we didn't want to mock, right? And working with customer data. So the last great frontier for us was getting what customer data munged in such a way that we could sync up our tests with. I hope I'm making sense. Mm-hmm. We could sync up our tests with it, and that's something we were trying to come up with, like data capture. There's some tools that you can spin up data, but there's also we wanted actually real customer data to drive some of our tests, and that was a challenge for us to sort of figure out how do you integrate that into the build environment. But a fundamental technique, virtualization.
Yes.
So, does everyone have a virtual environment? And so speak a little bit about your developers. Does everyone have their own virtual environment? Is their team a virtual environment? Yeah, how does that work?
Every team has a team server, which is virtual. Whenever I say server for about the next 5 minutes, it's all virtual.
Okay.
So every team has a team server that they can deploy from trunk on, or actually from whatever branch that they want to deploy on, whatever branch that they want. And that's how our teams attack that first level of testing. Of a developer says, okay, it's checked in, it's good to go, let's deploy to our team server. And we do that because up until about a year ago, we had a single test server. And we had to do a lot of syncing of, this team is ready to upgrade our test server with this version, but this team's not ready because they have these objects they've set up, and they have this huge test case, and we have to wait. So we said, well, let's just create a server for each team, and they can do it whenever they need to.
Yep.
And if they need to keep it stable for 2 weeks, they can do that. Or if they want to change it every hour, they can do that. So that has really helped reduce the feedback loop issue of a check-in and a test on a integrated system with customer data and things like that. Because
so the developer is working at their desktop on their own virtual environment, and then they promote that to the team virtual server.
Yes.
And test it. So I have a personal virtual.
Local.
A local environment.
Yep.
And I can be working off a branch or off a trunk or whatever. And I'm just trying to understand. And then I can promote that. And then that's my team. So if a team wanted to run like a partial regression test or something, that's where they would run it. They would run their own integrations there.
Yes. Now our main test server gets refreshed at midnight and runs an upgrade with anything that's changed at noon. So there's always a central place that's always fresh and new. But the team servers allow teams the flexibility to test when they need to, or if they have a large test case or set of test cases or set of regressions that are going to take 3 or 4 days, they don't have to pause those daily refreshes on the main test server. the main test server has kind of become sort of a pseudo demo of, okay, let's go look at what's out there and see what's happening. So it helps from a PO standpoint of being able to just take a view at what's going on across
the team. So that has the latest checked in done code from a team by team basis.
Yes, that pulls everything.
But the teams will be running ahead of that in some cases, right?
Or behind if they're running a week long.
Well, what I meant was ahead of they're running ahead from a development point of view behind the test server. So that's kind of cool. So that's your can I do demos any day? Like, so on a daily basis, that's pulling up current code to run?
Yep. Whenever we deploy, it pulls the current code from trunk or whatever branch they're pointing at, builds it, deploys it, sets all the test data up, and away we go.
So that's integrated. Yep. So that's completely, and you do demos, like PO demos and stuff on that. Correct. I like that.
Yep.
Okay. Well, branches.
Mm-hmm.
Branch strategy. So you mentioned the B word.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. But in all seriousness, one of the things I struggle with in Agile is there's this notion early on, a few years ago, I've read some, there's a couple of guys, I forget their name, Steve Berzook, there's another one who are well known in the the code management community, mm-hmm. and the CI community. And they talked about Agile is a run off the trunk methodology, right?
Yes.
You're, branching is bad.
Yep.
And so early on in Agile, and I think this is flexing, this is changing nowadays, but early on it was just like run off the trunk, branching is terrible because of the integration cost,
mm-hmm.
and just everyone is on sort of on that hairy edge of the trunk all the time.
Yes.
And you're integrating, and when I say integration, it's not just whether it could be manual integration, you're going mm-hmm. through manual pain of staying there. Are you on the trunk like that?
Yeah, I am a branch minimalist. I try and branch as little as possible because having been a developer and dealt with a very branchy tree, merging gets painful.
That sounded funny. Yeah. That sounds like a little... were you trying to inject a little humor there?
No.
No? Okay. It didn't work.
No, it did not. It was a slight play on words.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Yeah, I know.
Bear with me.
Emphasis on slight. You go ahead. So your branchy tree.
Right. So I just dealing with merges and what code should go in which branch and trying to make sure you don't get lost and you have five different environments set up on your developer PC for each branch and all those things. So we are a trunk-based team. So all of our development goes on in trunk. We only branch at the absolute last minute, and the branches are kept around for a maintenance path. So whenever if we are working on 6.2 and we're getting towards the end of it, at the very last minute, we'll branch to 6.2 and say, that's 6.2. And then the very last minute, again, next time around, we'll branch to 6.3, things like that.
And people are manually, people are manually replicating. Like if I'm fixing something that's relevant on 6.2 and 6.3, I fix it in both places or something.
We are pretty lucky because we have a new dev-only team. So the folks that are in my team are new dev-only. So they're basically trunk-only. The only time they ever have to worry about a secondary branch is in those last couple weeks of, okay, I need to check it into trunk, but I also, because this version isn't ready, I got to push it over into this branch. So it's our maintenance folks that really have to deal with the issues of all these various branches and which version should this check-in go to.
How many branches are they?
We support three back.
That's right. Now that I recall. So really going forward, you're branch minimalist.
Yeah.
And you're trunk focused, but because of your maintenance burden, you're actually not branch minimalist.
Right.
Those could be long-lived branches.
Yes.
They are long-lived branches, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I was curious about
that. Yeah, we're actually, which is going to make our numbering scheme more and more important, we're actually moving away from version support to a timeline-based support. So we're going to now support 3 years back. So if we do six versions in 3 years, that's six branches we have to support.
That's not that friendly from an Agile point of view, is it?
No.
If I'm understanding that correctly.
Right.
Because...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's something that we're trying to work through,
yeah.
The right way to do these things, just from a contractual corporate support point of view.
From my point of view, that previous company that I worked at was... And it was channeled by, so there's nothing wrong with saying it. It's a local e-commerce software as a service company. And a channel advisor, we were laser focused or just anal on the off the trunk, because I think the guy that led that team, that CI team, mm-hmm. had read some of these initial papers, and he, gosh, sometimes people read papers and they take it to heart, yeah. like it becomes yeah. part of their DNA, and so it was part of his DNA. God bless him. And it's but we stayed there, and it has trade offs, mm-hmm. right? It has, like anything, any of these strategies have trade-offs, but it worked relatively well for us. Where I'm at now, we're an off the trunk, so we try to stay off the trunk, but we're now doing story branches. So you may have heard me talk, I don't know if you and I have talked about this before, but we're asking, so they're short-lived, but there's many of them.
Yeah.
So
I start getting twitchy.
So for those of you that are just listening, Josh just had multiple facial tics just then when I mentioned the term story branches.
All right. I'll calm down. I'll give it a chance. I'll hear it out, and maybe
You know what? I struggle with it. It was one of those things as a leader that someone who reports to me is an idea,
right?
And we've rolled it out into the teams. And we discussed as teams, like you've seen this.
Yeah.
Not everything your teams do, do you absolutely,
right.
I hope,
right.
100% agree with.
Yeah.
Is it, no, or am I the only
it.
One?
That, you know, hey, try it.
So I'm like a try it kind of guy. So, but I was one of the early, like, what the hell are you talking about here, right?
Yeah.
But we've implemented story branches. And so in every team, so a team working in a sprint could have what? 8 branches,
right, yeah.
on an individual story basis that they spin up to work on. What are some of the pros of that approach? Before we talk about cons.
I'll let you handle that part.
What? The pros are independence, sort of independence of stories. So if you want to withdraw a story.
Right.
If you want to, you know, check one in, but then if we've decided later on that we have too many bugs in it, not, that's a bad example for us. We don't have that. But let's say the product owner changes their mind and deprioritizes that story, or it has an integration. It has an integration side effect with another story. Oh. Then we start having the ability to promote, but also to withdraw, not code.
So you have
but stories.
Orphans. Lying around everywhere.
No, yeah, that's
a little mini orphanage.
No, actually, we don't. We don't have. It gives us the ability to do that. That doesn't mean that we we do that often. It's actually worked out.
Oliver Twist.
The only solid effect I've seen is there's merge contention, like when the last day.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So we send out
integration
these,
becomes really painful, right?
Well, so what are some? So now we've gone to cons. Also the work. Well, the work focus in not dealing with chunks of code just on the trunk. So everything is this very large ocean of code changes, right? It's given us sort of workflow granularity on the positive side of you're dealing with things in a named way. It's stories, right? It's story branches. There's containers. That actually has benefits to it. You're testing stories, right? The stories have state. The major cons for me that I've seen, the one that I was originally concerned about, and it's still true, is integration. Mm-hmm. We have integration issues, and we're also deferring integration. So you integrate a story that doesn't necessarily at the team level, and you declare team victory, but you don't necessarily do what? Integrate
product victory.
At a product victory level. So we're deferring that, and we're finding that at later points. That's my major issue. So mm-hmm. trunk-based stuff finds those integration issues much earlier than this story-based stuff. Right. Because individual teams, you're deferring product integration to a later point, right? All of the teams are integrating. They're doing their best to test their stories.
Right.
And that nothing stops them from doing cross-team integration. But we have found gaps. We have found integration gaps. So that's, to me, one of the biggest drawbacks. The other drawback is just this rush. I mean, it's frenetic. Because now we have, from a configuration management perspective, you get this, like people are blocking each other for checking things in, like the last day of a sprint,
yeah.
or the ninth day of a sprint, you have everyone merging what their story branches in. Yeah. So there's collisions
mm-hmm.
from that point of view. There's contention. There's people who are blocked out sometimes because it's just from a workflow point of view, from a person workflow point of view. So that's a drawback, I think, as well. And I think you're not thinking. So that rush, so it exacerbates the integration risk.
Correct.
So I personally think it's the biggest thing for me that I'm concerned about is integration. This is the first release where we've done it. We played around with it in the last release, in a release sequence.
Does it come up in retrospectives or anything?
They like it.
Really?
It scares the crap out of me. Wow. I twitch like you do. Yeah. I would, if it would have been up to me, I would have not. So if I would have been the master of the universe,
right,
I probably would have said no. This is just not a good idea because of the integration risk. It doesn't. We seem to be working it out. I think this is our first major release, and we actually have a pause now. We're code complete, but we're waiting to release until the first week of January.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. We'll see how the integration has gone this time. And you know, we measure those escapes and things, so
right,
we'll find that stuff out. But
right,
I find it to be it's an interesting technique, but it sort of borders on, you know, deferring integration debt.
Yeah, that's my gut reaction. Is it feels like you're taking a very healthy feedback loop and throwing it out the window, and say we're going to wait and find out at the very last minute whether all this works. And to me, that's
or later. Later, yeah. That's my...
Well, later is your plan, but it always ends up
integration. No, we have integration. We plan integration test fests, we call them,
right,
where we do plan from a release point of view across team. But it's late,
right?
To your point. I mean, there's late the last day, which is too late,
right?
But then there's just late. So we are testing late, and in some cases we're probably going to find something at some point that just hoses us, and it's too late,
mm-hmm,
and we'll just have to. But again, trust the team. See what the team comes,
yep,
up with, and let us learn. And it may, you know, it may work out for us in our context. It's funny, the champion of that technique. So what's his name? Martin Fowler and Jez Humble from ThoughtWorks fame,
mm-hmm,
wrote a book. They've moved continuous integration forward, and they've talked about it being continuous deployment. And so the shtick for them, it's the same mantra. But they're like, you should always be ready to introduce. So instead of always being integrated, you're always be ready to what? To have the customer use the product. So, and sort of like your test environment.
Right.
And I'm sure there's risks. So I'm sure your test environment isn't customer ready, like prime time ready. But they're trying to say, you know, get it as close to prime time ready as you can. But from their point of view, like story branches are like counter. You know, they had an incredibly negative reaction to it. I think in their book, they talk about it as being asinine.
Yeah.
So they took some of the wind out of our sails from that point of view. What are your how do you branch? I mean, how do you, like, promotion models? Do you go through, so you said developer, desktop, to?
To a team test server, to a product test server.
To production?
Yeah.
Eventually to production. So you're cycling through three environments, basically.
Correct.
All the time,
mm-hmm.
So we're doing the same thing. We're going from developer desktop using what? It's story branches. So
mm-hmm.
Folks are working in the story branches themselves, story environments. So we're story focused to what? The teams integrate in a team server,
mm-hmm.
again a virtualized server,
right.
And then we go to QA. Actually, and then we go to staging. So we sort of have, what would that be, four environments equivalent to what you're doing. Now, our staging environment is...
We do have a final staging, but again, that's a last-minute stage of really... so we actually have media, right? We are on a SaaS model. So
you are not a SaaS model.
Correct.
Yeah.
So we have that final staging is we do the media testing, we install it, we do all that stuff, and actually give it its... full testing there and go from there. So we do have that fourth step, but it is pretty last minute. But we're pretty confident at that point. It's just more of a sanity check just to make sure nothing went crazy.
Well, that's like your pre-production, like duplication of CDs and things.
Yeah.
So you're actually less, I'm asking, but you're less checking code viability. You're more checking like package viability.
Yes. Yeah.
Packaging.
Yeah, the code stability at that point is determined and agreed upon, and we're ready to ship. So
yep.
It's now, let's do one final check of the packaging. So I guess it's more of a packaging deployment server or something fancy like that. We should write a book about it.
I don't know. Well, I think that's a competitive landscape, right?
Yeah.
Is that area, but So why don't we wrap up? This is like part, this is part one of what we were talking
2.1.
about. 2.1. So this was, yeah, part deux, point uno. Man, my linguist capabilities are astounding, aren't they?
They are.
Oh, very my impressive. God. I apologize to the audience in advance for my stupidity in linguistics. I've been traveling lately.
Just in that area? That's the
Well, we've
area
both been traveling in that yes. area, right? And I am the ugly American when it comes to I speak no. Do you speak any languages like?
Espanol.
Do you speak
si,
Spanish?
Senor.
Really? Yeah. I wish I'd have had you. I was just in I was in Argentina last week, and I felt like the ugly American. I didn't understand. What did I get? At the end of the trip, it was si, por favor, and...
I didn't even try when I was in China. I didn't even try.
Right? Isn't it bad?
I was that jerk that was just like, there's like three words I know. I'm not even going to insult you.
I don't think it's a jerk. I think actually being a jerk is trying those three words and then joking around. I think it's better to just admit I'm not even competitive in this landscape.
Yeah.
So CI, what, if we want to leave the audience with a couple keys, what do you think they would be?
CI, if you have the opportunity, start it early. It's always going to be easier to grow with it as opposed to bolt on. That's kind of the one big thing. And give it its fair shake. Don't set it up and walk away. Give it its treatment. Actually, set aside some resources to work on it continually. You know, continually improve your continuous integration environment. Don't leave it there. What's next? What else are we talking about?
I'd say hire someone who's actually done it.
Yeah.
So don't... I think it's a mistake. Not that you can't do it, but to just have a developer and then say, hey, here you're like your 25% of your time is going to be on CI.
Mm-hmm.
It's your part-time focus. I actually think it's a really specialized expertise. And there's mature people in the world. So at least hire one person who has actually had CI experience across mm-hmm. a variety of tools and leverage them. So build your CI project around them and consider, just like testers, you want to hire professional testers.
Right.
Maybe try to hire a professional CI person. I agree with what you're saying. Invest in it.
Yeah.
And it's hard. So there's another place, another yes. word is in a lot of environments, like I've done some consulting in telephone, so communication companies and things like that, a little bit of consulting. And in those places, they have like legacy systems up the wazoo. So 175 application environments spread across the planet, different build environments, different tooling. So they look at that, from looking at that environment, if you want to be agile in that environment, you get scared to death about CI.
Yep.
And what they do is they ignore it because it's like it's this huge mountain of technical debt. And I'm like, don't solve it in one iteration, but don't ignore it, right? Mm-hmm. Just start whittling away. So I think CI has the potential of, depending on how big your company is, technical debt or fear factor, but cut through that. Because I don't think you can be agile if you're using traditional build techniques and traditional environment techniques. You need this, I think you need that plumbing of supporting you to be iterative.
Yes.
That's it. Okay. Matt, mind of the actual tester. I'm going to punt it to you.
Whoa.
I know. What do you think? You're leading teams now. And I mean, I know you're in a matrix organization where you don't, where there's a, you have a peer at a test level,
mm-hmm.
a peer to you. But you're also, one of the nice things about agile teams is that they're cross-functional. So you're observing all the time testers. So what do you think the mind, not the tooling is, but what is the mindset of the agile tester? What do you expect? If you were interviewing agile testers, what would you interview for?
The things I look for is, are they a team player? And is it going to be a dev versus test thing? Or is it, we'll do whatever we need to do to make this happen? From there, I certainly look for automation of how are we going to make this better. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have all this automation tool experience, but what I want to see is that they're trying things, is that they say, you know what, I got really sick and tired of running these same tests at my last job over and over and over again, so here's what I tried. Did it work? No, but I tried it, and here's what I want to do, and this is how I want to try and tackle that. So I want to see that curiosity in how can I make this better? And I look for that for anybody that's a part of the Agile team. So tester, developer, anything. So at that point, just that continual investigation, both from process, but in actually looking at the test cases and not leaving their test cases in a stagnant mode of just, well, that's a test case we wrote 6 months ago and it's, you know, it's fine. I don't need to go back and inspect it and see if it really makes sense. So that's my quick spiel.
No, you made some important, you started slowly from my, not slowly, but like team player, you know, you want people to be team players, but then you hit some, you started hitting what I was hoping you'd hit, or I was curious whether you hit like what I think are some key things and differences between traditional testers. So to me, traditional testing is sort of a boring, stupid, check your brain. So any traditional testers that ever listen to this, I love you. And this is couched, and I mean this with all due respect, but I think traditional testing has lost its way. And so you actually get credit for blindly. So one thing you get credit for, and the business expects you to do, is to blindly execute test cases.
Right. So my argument is that traditional testing should be replaced by automation.
Okay.
And that's going to be difficult for some people to hear because it's like, hey, that's my job.
Right.
You know, but I think if you want to be agile, if you want to be as proficient and efficient as possible, I think those traditional testing tasks need to be automated, or else you're going to get passed, lapped, you know, just totally.
Well, you're going to get lapped externally. This is good. I mean, so early, right before the Medicast, you were like, Bob, you're going to have to drive the testing part of this. And I'm thinking that, no, Josh, you have something to share here.
I'm done.
No, you're not.
That's all you're getting from. You got 22 minutes on your own here, buddy. Go.
No, I couldn't fill 22 minutes of silence, Josh. Are you saying that I'm verbose, Josh?
I didn't say that.
I didn't say that.
I didn't disagree.
No, but it's this automation. But it's not, you're talking about the competitive side of it. I'm also talking about the, what the hell are you doing? Why aren't you improving yourself?
Right.
Automated to get time to figure out what else to test. Automated to figure out, to have time to figure out what tests are running now that are no longer relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So deactive. So another thing that traditional testers think is you never, like if you say delete a test case, they're like, holy crap.
Yep.
Right? So you want the ever increasing pile of test cases. But they don't go back and maintain them. So they get more and more irrelevant over time. Now, you're running a lot,
mm-hmm.
but they're more irrelevant. They don't maintain them. I know I'm stereotyping. They don't think. They don't evolve with the software. And what I want from, so the mindset to me of the Agile tester from a curiosity perspective, or let's use test cases, is you should be always challenging what test cases you've written. You should be always challenging the value of the test cases.
Mm-hmm.
You should always be running agile principles. Always running what? High-value test cases first, right? And if you don't get to, and repeating them, right? So repeating the high-value test cases and not repeating the low-value and even pruning those low-value test cases. How do you determine value? You work not by your, so traditional testers would sit in their cube and put on their hat and say, I'm going to determine what the value proposition is. Very erroneously, they would also, you know, all, it's all valuable, so I'm not done until I run all 100% of them. Well, that's a bad mindset. Or they wouldn't ask anyone else. And I think agile testers, what? They take prioritization from the team. So they talk to developers, they talk to scrum masters, they talk to product owners, they have dialogue around, you know, it's not my test, it's who? It's our tests. It's our test suite. What do we think we want to run? What do we think we want? So automation, you know, I'll challenge you, and I know you didn't say this, but you don't want to automate every test, right? Not every test is automatable.
Correct.
Not every test warrants automation, the cost of automation. Some tests, you might only run them once a quarter, once a year, once a half year or something. That may be the nature of those things, right? They may be hardware-dedicated tests that you, like in your environment, you hit pre-production tests.
Right.
Who the heck wants to automate? You know, and if it takes a half an hour to run 30 pre-production tests, and you run them once a year, mm-hmm. someone can do them in 30 minutes manually, one person or two people can do that, I'd say just let them alone.
Yep.
You know, move on. So I think you hit it. The thinking, the curiosity to get better. One of the things I don't know if you've I don't know if you've seen it in your culture, but traditional testers really struggle moving the mindset. They want to run things by rote. They don't like transparency.
Yes. Well, I've seen that at just a team level. So the traditional developer, tester, any of those roles, trying to transition, it's been the transparency of, wait, so you're telling me I have to tell you what I'm running and why I'm running
And why I'm running it.
And I have to validate that this makes sense. I can't just run these 50 tests I've been running every week.
And I can't just say, give me a week and I'll run these 50 tests in that week, and without any explanation or collaboration around that. But that's a very common pattern.
Yep.
I mean, you get it in developers, but I think almost by rote you get it in testers. That's why I sort of go out there and hammer on the mindset of the agile tester, that stuff doesn't cut it. That is so counter to an agile team that it's like oil and water. You can't even enter the team with that. Well, you can, but it destroys the mindset, right? It destroys the productivity of the team.
Yeah, I've taken to something we've talked about last Metacast, acceptance tester on development, as trying to push that team ownership of all tests, of unit tests, acceptance tests, feature tests, any kind of test, right? Those are owned by the team, and trying to help push the other sources within our team to drive some of that pruning or drive some of the improvement.
So you said you've made that shift? You've increased that in your teams?
Increased visibility and actual activity in it. It was something that we were doing, and it's like, hey, look at that. We're doing it. We didn't even know we were doing it. So I started pushing it and being able to throw that buzzword out there and say, hey, why don't you read about this and see if it makes sense, and push it on my team leads and things like that. You know, we're doing this. Let's see if we can take it to the next level.
Yep.
And what part of it makes sense for us to push really hard, and what should we push pretty softly, things like that. So trying to get the awareness of it out more, and that's made a bit of a difference.
Continue. So, I mean, that takes time, right? Yeah. That takes time, but that's actually good to hear. There's a couple of traditional techniques that I want to introduce, like Metacasters, to the traditional testing techniques that I think work in Agile. So there's this, if you ever heard the notion risk-based testing, have you heard? So risk.
I have. I spent some time with you, and you spoke about it once or twice.
Have I?
At our limited engagement working together.
Yeah, so risk-based testing is not an agile technique. It's a traditional technique that a lot of teams, the traditional teams, don't use very well. It's engaging. What you do is you list the test cases. You know, you can use spreadsheets, you can use charts, whatever. But for software, you list test cases or suites on the left, and then you engage your stakeholders. You don't just decide on yourself, but you talk in terms of phased execution of those test cases. So what you're trying to do is generate collaboration. And in its best case, you would run like a risk-based test planning workshop where you could get customers in there, you'd get functional managers in there, you'd get developers in there, you get a few test leads in there, people who are more leaders, who have pervasive knowledge. And you say, hey, boys and girls, you know, we have limited resources, we have limited people. We have all this. We have a test repository of cases, old. We have tests that we have to write new. You have different types of tests, like performance or security test over functional tests. And we have time. And you talk about, and you engage folks in understanding, hey, this is what we're changing in the application set or creating, and where do we invest ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
And instead of having it be the old view was, well, you know, that you have a test team, so guys just earn your paycheck, and we expect you to test everything, and they never could, that you try to create sort of a team view to priority. So the risk-based is prioritized-driven testing. Usually you make it cyclical, so you overlay it on top of, like in RUP, RUP iterations, or you could even overlay it. You could do it in Waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, we're going to get 5 code drops, you know, in Waterfall. Typically there's iterative drops to test no matter what methodology you're in.
Yeah.
So you talk about, what are we going to do in drop 1? What are we going to do in drop 2? What are we going to do in drop 3? But you really share the responsibility. The other thing you do is you talk about what you're not going to test. So you clearly expose risk. And I've used the technique, you know, very well in cases where I didn't have enough people, And I would say it's something like, I'm not going to do, you know, I'm going to focus on functional tests. I'm not going to do any performance tests. And it turned out when we did the review of the risk-based plan, a few folks had issues with that, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I'm like, okay, that's great to have your issue. Now, what do we,
right?
If I do,
what do we sacrifice?
What do we sacrifice? Yeah. It's great that you're, you know, the developers, I'm up in arms. That's unacceptable, Bob. Yeah. Well, yes, I'm glad that you're up in arms, but what are we going to do about it, right? And what are we? So it was actually one of the early we. You know how Agile is like not a you thing, not a develop versus test thing, but it's a we thing. It was very we. And I think those techniques, so if Metacasters, if you have traditional testers coming into Agile, use that buzzword of risk-based testing. I think it's something, it's a hook. I think it's an effective hook. Any reactions to that? Do you guys?
I didn't know it was pre-Agile. It just seemed inherently Agile, so I just assumed it was Agile-based.
It's a pre-Agile thing. Now, a lot of testers are uncomfortable with it because it has what? It has the seek, the collaboration word in it. We don't like collaboration.
And they also have to unveil that they don't run every test.
And they also have to unveil. Exactly.
Yeah.
And you have to be vulnerable. You have to be mature, yeah. Right? You have to, and not take it personally. So I think it's a really effective technique, but there's a maturity aspect to it. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I went into a team and what was the ratio? It was funny. I'll just tell this funny quick story, but I think there were like 50 developers and there were like 3 testers. Ooh. Not a good ratio.
Yeah.
Would you think?
Yeah.
And the CTO of that company fully expected that those testers were testing every freaking thing. And, I mean, that was just his view. His view was, you know, I've got 3 really strong testers, you know, and they're working hard. They better cover it. You know, that's plenty of resource to cover everything. And I came in, and all I did, I wasn't trying to grind an axe, but I just exposed. One of the first actions I took is just putting a matrix up and exposing what we were and we're not covering,
mm-hmm.
and based on the resource load. And I mean, literally, you could have dropped. I mean, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. It was like, holy crap, what's going on? And I brought up and the other, and then I the cherry on top was, and guys, and what I did is I painted the testing proposition release over release. So what was happening as they were growing, as they were hiring developers. So the curve was getting worse,
yeah,
right, over time. Yeah. So I was like, because they were like, oh, my God, this is a problem. I said, not only is it a problem now, but about a year from now, we're going to get to close to single digits in test coverage. That's some bad news for you,
yeah.
Right? And but then they came through. They came through. It actually created, and it is, I think it's an Agile. It's indicative of Agile, pre-Agile, of transparency. Honesty is good. Integrity is good.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like the answer, but then they faced it. Making things transparent, uncovering problems, and shoving them in the nose of teams and leadership, we responded. So we doubled or tripled the team. That wasn't the only answer. We brought tooling in. We brought some contractors in. We started focusing on automation,
yeah.
Right, more. But that transparency helped. So that's a hook. What else? You have any thoughts? Mindset of the Agile Tester.
I told you, I gave my spiel. You got another, like, 10 minutes to go.
I have another 10 minutes to go. I'm going to turn it around on you. So I think one of the tenets, one of the mindset aspects of the Agile Tester is to start not testing less. I want to hear your reaction. So I think the best Agile Testers might even approach a point where they don't test at all, but they integrate with the customer. And they pull the customer in a variety of ways into the Agile team. So
they get
facilitate
the test,
that.
And they get the customer to do the testing?
No, I'm saying I didn't say they don't.
I'm trying to follow here. You're saying you're asymptotically
approaching zero. The whole team. So whose job is it to test?
Everybody.
Everybody. So if everyone's job to test, then that tester, they're part of it, but now it's 20% of their time, arguably. What do they do with the other 80%?
Right,
I
so
might argue that they waltz up to the front of the line and start maybe pulling that customer.
Question for you.
Yeah.
Who should the automators be? Are you of the belief that automated test cases should be written, maintained by the test team, by the developers, or by some crossbreed?
So there is no crossbreed. There are only Agile what?
Right.
teams.
Right. Okay.
It should be maintained by the team. So that agile pyramid, I think we talked about it the last time. So there's unit tests, there's middle tier tests, and there's, let's just arguably say there's a universe of three tiers of tests.
Right.
I'm not trying to be stuck. But there's unit level tests, which is the domain predominantly of the
developer teammates.
The developer teammates, and they should be automatable. They should be running all the time. Let's go to the top, the tip of the pyramid. There are UI-centered, you know, broad-based tests, call them, you know, cross-functional tests, call them steel thread tests, golden thread tests, major workflow tests that customers would do. The top 10 activities, workflows that a customer in your system would do very often because they're critical and crucial, but there's only 10 of them. There's not 2,000 of them. To automate them in a UI-centric test. They're going to break, right? They're going to be brittle, but only since there's 10 of them and they're so valuable and you're running them all the time because they're customer-facing, then you're going to have the wherewithal to fix them. To me, those who could write them, automate them, that could be testers. That's traditionally a tester role, but developers could write them just like testers could write unit tests.
Okay.
And then the middle tier is sort of a free-for-all of whoever, you know, whoever gets there first, whoever can, I think, can do that. So the developers and the testers can do that. The middle tier, one of the neat things about the middle tier is it's starting to be non-programmatic. So at the endpoints of the pyramid, unit tests are clearly they're clearly engineer-driven.
Yes.
You're clearly writing code. And at the Selenium level or at the UI level, you're clearly, you know, if you're doing frameworks, if you're not doing capture playback, you are probably writing code.
Yeah.
But in that middle tier, there's a lot of table-driven stuff, right? There's a lot of constraint-driven stuff, like human-readable-driven stuff. So actually, believe it or not, laymen can write tests. Now you need someone to wire it into the app.
Correct.
But laymen can write the test and they can extend the test.
So that's the cucumber as the fitness.
The cucumber and the fitnesses have this side effect where laymen, if they care to engage, if they're motivated to engage, like the product owner, for example, or a tester who has no programming background whatsoever, but can actually extend, they have the ability to extend tests. As behavior changes, they can extend the test to mirror that behavior. And how do they know the behavior is changing? They're talking to their development partners. Why do you ask?
Well, because I was hoping to get the answer of testing is everybody's.
One? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Because I get that question of a lot.
What I hate is these testing, and I've created one. So, again, I'm not, you know, we come onto the Medicast sometimes, and I hope we don't come off as these obnoxious know-it-alls because we're not, we go with the flow, but I've sort of created an automation factory, and I hate that part. What do I mean by an automation factory? You have history in your company with automation factories. It's the Dane few, the small number of special people who have to write all of the test automation. And that's not the right answer. Now, I've created them sometimes. I created mine to get some traction on Selenium, to write a framework,
right?
But it didn't work out the way. Those automation factories are really hairy things sometimes to get right.
They are easy traps to fall into.
They are really easy traps to fall into. Right now, I haven't destroyed the factory, but I've retired the factory and... And we're working on unit tests and middle tier tests, and it's everyone. So until we get the right mindset, it's sort of a free for all. I'm fostering that free for all attitude.
Yeah. So the reason I ask is I get asked that a lot. A lot of new teams I go to talk about automation and CI, and they say, "Well, who writes the tests? You know, is it developers, testers? Who does it?" And you know, the answer that we want, and the answer that I always give, is everybody does. Maybe there's somebody that works on the framework, but we all own the tests. Everybody owns the tests. There's no single test.
But no one likes that answer. No. They want the factories, don't they? They want this clear role and responsibility. They want to be able to pass the buck and say, but those factories don't work. I mean, in your case, I'm not going to pull out names or anything, but I remember the factory was like, you know, I remember talking to factory people, testers, and it's a single point of failure. It's a single workflow. It's like, you know, I will write every framework, you know, every framework component. So the person has a queue of 8,000 framework requests, and meanwhile the teams aren't automating because it's just the wrong, it's absolutely the wrong model. what I like about the open source tools is they're starting to, you know, I'm less and less friendly to frameworks. You know, you need a little bit of a framework or something, mm-hmm. but I think it's very lightweight frameworks, more guidelines, and then just throw it out into the community and just let people do that. We're breaking our factory. We're going to take our factory engineers, and I mean that respectfully. If anyone is listening from iContact, there's no, you know, I'm not slamming anyone. It's just, we made that decision, but I want those testers that were writing the framework, we want them out into the teams. And we want them developing right. real-world automation at a team level on a story-by-story basis where it matters, right? We want them in the game, directly in the game. I think it's the same thing for UX. You know, it's not test-centric. I mean, so you can have user design outside of the teams, which is sort of the same thing. Now I have a UX factory that I have to sort of, inject it into the teams.
Same here.
Right. And that can kind of work.
Again, another slippery slope that's very easy to fall into.
Right. And or do you somehow try to get it closer and couple it?
Yep.
What else? I want to talk about context.
Talk fast.
So real quickly, there's a couple hooks for traditional testers. Exploratory testing rocks. I don't think you guys have done that. I don't know.
It's peppered in here and there.
But there's some
consistent.
There's something we do called charter-based or session-based exploratory testing. So we actually have charters, which are little written. They replace test cases. They actually replace multiple test cases. So we could say do login across a multitude of authentication systems. Test authentication could be a charter. For 30 minutes, test all of our authentication for a system and test password management and test, you know, so not just entry into the system, but all of the password management and authentication and even some of the administrative details mm-hmm. for that. So that could be a charter. And then what we do, but we don't give the details. We don't say test. We don't put the steps right. in there. And yeah. we don't put the test this and look for this result. So that's sort of the by rote, if we have a brain, we should, and we know the app at all, that what you want with the session or the session charter tells you sort of the area. It gives you a bounded area to test, and then it's up to you to decide what to test. And then instead of having scripts to tell you what to test inside it, you keep notes of what you tested and what bugs you found as a script. So you keep notes based on your findings. You throw bugs after the session is over, but it's sort of, you explore. And you're unbounded. So you can decide if you know someone didn't touch some code to what? Skip it. Mm-hmm. You're making a risk-based decision. And you may be right or you may be wrong, but you can, that's fair game. If you see something that doesn't look right over here, you're free to what? Explore that. Oh, that doesn't look right. You can extend a little bit beyond your session boundaries mm-hmm. and go and look for bugs. Not in performance of the system, but in a related territory. So we have about, I think right now, 30 to 35 sessions or charters defined that are areas of our code that we call our regression test, a charter-based regression test, and we pair up and we run those things. So we have pairs, not testers, but team members who run our charters, and we keep logs, we find bugs. We use that as a place to sort of, if we see a test that we don't have a test case for, we actually will drive formal test cases out of this if we find gaps mm-hmm. in our test cases. But we probably use exploratory session-based testing, probably it encompasses maybe 40% of our testing, I think. And it's really it's sort of our bridge between automation, because we're light on automation and we don't want to do heavy scripted. So we're sort of, if we do heavy scripted, meaning follow the yeah. bouncing ball of test cases, it's going to take forever. So we use exploratory testing as sort of that middle ground. The other cool thing for us is it's helped with getting, you know, that shared mindset you were talking about of getting developers, not just writing, but have shared ownership of quality. It's really driven that. So early on, we would get a lot of whining and a lot of pushback. We would also get developers who just didn't test. Mm-hmm. It was funny. Since we keep these logs, we actually keep, you can look, you can actually see someone who didn't give a crap about the test, yep. right? And you can, and we would expose that, not in back, but we would have retrospectives, and we remove the name, and it's like, oh, this is a really good one. I wonder who did that, and we'd celebrate the good ones. And look, no one gave it. No, this one here clearly didn't care at all about what they were doing. Yep. Wonder who that was. Don't know. And we applied some peer pressure, and we've gotten, I think, a lot of improvement. We've also put some steps in our charters. So we learned that they were too loose, mm-hmm. right? And but we didn't overload them too much. But our charters now are maybe approaching 2 pages of sort of guidance or direction or something. But very okay. useful. Do you do any of that?
Like I said, it's peppered in. It's at a team level. Like a team feels like, okay, there's this area of the app that we own that we doesn't have the coverage that we need. So we're going to spend an hour blasting away at it and see what happens.
That'd be an area to stretch your teams, actually. Yeah. I mean, the nice thing, again, exploratory testing predates Agile. Mm-hmm. Has nothing. It's been around maybe 5, 7, 8 years before Agile. It works in any methodology. It's time-boxed. Has a lot of the Agile accoutrements. You're mm-hmm. trusting, instead of trusting your writing, you're trusting the team. You're trusting our brain instead of what process and things like that. So I think the mindset of the Agile tester, we covered the major things I want.
Yeah, there's some more things we could potentially do.
But I think you hit the key, believe it or not. I think curiosity, thinking out of the box, a lack of by rote, not allowing yourself to get comfortable in repeating steps all the time. I think that's like a danger for testers, because it's the nature of your work is like repetition. And in, you know, maybe I think historically you got compensated for that. You got mm-hmm. rewarded for that.
Like developers used to get paid for writing the same code.
Right, on a line of code basis. Yeah. And you got into this repetition, this brainless stuff. And now it doesn't, in Agile it doesn't work. Right. And in fact, you stand out like a sore thumb.
Correct.
Have we wrapped it? Have we? Can we stick, I think we can stick a fork.
Oh yeah, big old like turkey fork.
Next Medicast. Hey, so I want to encourage Medicasters, send in some ideas. I want an idea that my esteemed colleague here can drive more than me. So I think what I want to put on the table is sort of like refactoring and unit tests and IDEs.
A tools discussion.
And a tools discussion.
Tools versus non-tools.
But I want it also to be very developer-centric, which is going to be an area that you can drive.
Okay.
Would you buy into that?
I will grab the keys and go.
I think that's your... Okay. So the next one... Just by the very definition of the topic, you get to drive, because it's it can be tools generic, but it's developer tools. And I want to learn something from this. I want to pick your brain.
Uh-oh.
Yes.
Uh-oh. All right.
So, from beautiful downtown Cary, North Carolina, at the end of 2010.
Yes. I wish we could sing.
We can't.
No.
You want to? No. You can start. No. I will hum along. No?
No, it's bad.
For Bob Galen.
And Josh Anderson.
Happy holidays.
Same to you, sir.
And shake.
And bake.
Y'all take care now.
See ya.